Chapter 13. Shopping. Jet lag has its own microclimate. Grey, sticky, Singaporean. I move through the stinging February rain with almost tropical lethargy. Step out into Longacre, straight into the path of a courier. Through the visor, I can see eyes full of hatred.
You stupid cow, he spits out. Can't you fucking look where you're going?
40 minutes to spare before Rod and I have a meeting with consultants in Covent Garden, just off the piazza. Enough time to run into L.K. Bennett 50% shoe sale. I think I've forgotten how to shop for pleasure. No lingering foreplay for me. No harmless flirtation with chenille and silk before getting off with aloof linen or gorgeous cuddly alpaca. These days I shop like a locust, famished, ruinous, hoovering up anything I need and things I definitely won't need but deserve anyway because I never have time to go shopping. Grab a pair of fudge pencil heels, good for treading on guys' toes, and calf-length caramel-soft boots. As an afterthought, I pick up some black slingbacks patterned with so many punch holes it looks like braille for foot fetishists. Funny how two pairs of shoes feels extravagant, but three is a bargain. Across the shop, I glimpse a glossy brunette, a triumph of Botox over gravity, swaddled in dove-grey cashmere. She is considering each shoe like a judge at a flower show. Can tell she has time as well as money on her hands. I see a whole day of browsing stretching ahead of her, a prairie of possibility dotted with skinny lattes and a delicious light lunch. I notice her eyes land on a pair of zebra mules on the size 6 rack. She must be stopped. Execute Charlie's Angels pirouette and get to them just in time.
Excuse me, I was picking those up.
Her voice is peevish, as aggrieved as someone that languid will allow herself to be. Sorry, I was here first, I say, jamming toe into zebra.
No need to be aggressive.
She smiles and trails away, leaving a slipstream of Jo Malone tuberose. Is she not fragrant? Certainly. Does one not want to strangle her eerily wrinkle-free neck? You bet. At the till, the assistant pauses when she gets to the zebra mules and turns them over.
These aren't your size, madam.
I know. I'm taking them anyway. The credit card machine chunters busily and then gags.
Sorry, madam. Your card has been rejected. I'll have to make a call.
I don't have time for you to make a call. The assistant smirks.
Shall we try another card?
10:36 a.m. 6 minutes, 35 seconds late for meeting. Enter room full of suits, trying to hide gleaming carrier bag behind knees. Rod Task looks up from his notes with a shark's grin.
Ah, when the going gets tough, the ladies go shopping. Good of you to join us, Katie.
12:19 p.m. 4 days to go till Emily's half term, but am way too busy to have booked a relaxing break. Paula is off to Morocco for the week. When I tentatively inquired this morning if there was any chance of her ever taking a holiday to coincide with ours, she shot me her Joan of Arc put those matches down look. So I offered to pay for her flight. Weak, Kate. Very weak. Pretend to be checking fund valuations while making call to travel agent. How about Florida? Hyena cackle at the other end of the phone.
Fully booked since October, sorry.
Disneyland, Paris?
Non.
Eurostar apparently groaning with loathsome forward planners. It would be wise to book for Easter now, the agent says. He still has a few spaces left for Easter.
Have you thought about Centre Parks, Mrs. Shattuck?
Yes, I have thought about Centre Parks, like going to hell in a Tupperware container. I try Cornwall, Cotswold, and the Canaries, all full. Eventually get through to some firm called Kimru Cottages. Valda says, miraculously, she has a cancellation outside St. David's. On the cozy side, mind, but you can't go wrong with an open fire, can you? I'm just getting ready to leave for lunch when the post-room lad arrives at my desk, looking rather sheepish. He is carrying 2 bunches of Valentine flowers. One, gardenias, lilies, white roses as big as a hand, looks like Grace Kelly's wedding bouquet. The other consists of garage forecourt tulips, padded out with funeral director fern. Open the cards. The tulips are from my husband. To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Don't be freaked out about knits. Knits are now very middle class. Felix's school just had Knits Day to remove the stigma of knits. How was your hammer man in New York? The only good thing about our situation is that we are far too knackered to commit adultery. Lunch Thursday, right? Deb. Kisses. To Deborah Richardson, from Kate Reddy. Good to know knits have become oppressed minority group with their own EU funding, rather than pest you have to comb out of groaning child's hair every night. Tried tea tree oil, stank, but no use. Now onto chemical stuff brewed by Saddam Hussein. But will it kill the kids before it kills the knits? Sorry, can't do lunch. Forgot it was half term. Think the hammer man just sent me major Valentine bouquet. To Kate Reddy, from Candy Stratton. Bad news, hun. Slow Richard rang while you were out, and stupid secretary said, "Oh, your flowers are so much nicer than those tulips she got." Pretend you have florist stalker, preferably gay florist stalker. P.S. Thanks for crazy zebra shoes. Did you shoot them yourself? To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Kate, we are too tired for adultery, aren't we? Kisses. To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Don't do anything disgusting and amoral. Without telling me everything. D. Kisses. 1:27 p.m. Half an hour for lunchless lightning brows in gleaming electronics emporium near Liverpool Street. The atmosphere in the shop is delirious, malarial. Everyone in here has too much money and not enough time to spend it. I spot a guy from our tech team reverently cupping a digital camera as if it were a chunk of the true cross. It only takes a minute to find exactly what I'm looking for. The latest, dinkiest personal organizer. A truly gorgeous thing. Implausibly light, but with a pleasing scientific heft. And witty, too, like a 50s drinks coaster. The pocket memory comes with an impressive raft of promises. It will simplify your life, banish stress, pay your bills, remember your friends' birthdays, have sex with your husband while you finish that Carol Shields novel you started some weeks into your first pregnancy. I say I'll take it. I don't even ask how much. One way or another, I've earned it. 2:08 p.m. Rod Task approaches my desk like a marine storming a beach.
Katie, I need your help, he hollers.
Then, ominously, he parts his lips and clenches his teeth to form what he thinks is a smile. Rod is only really scary when he's trying to be nice. Playfully cuffing a daffodil in the vase on my desk, he tells me he wants me to do a final for a $300 million ethical pension fund account. Finals are a sort of beauty contest in which rival investment managers vie to convince a prospective client that they are the most responsible gambler in town. Oh, and Rod forgot to mention the final when he heard about it, so I only have 12 days to prepare, although this is now my fault, because if it wasn't my fault, it means Rod made a mistake. And Rod is a man, so that can't be right. I can hear myself starting to protest a long way off, a watery wail of injustice, but Rod bulldozes on.
They want us to field a team that reflects EMF's commitment to diversity, he says. So I reckon that's got to be you, Katie. And the chinky from research.
I beg your pardon?
Momo, right?
Momo is not Chinese. She's Sri Lankan.
Whatever. He shrugs. She looks pretty fucking diverse to me.
Rod, I simply can't. Momo has absolutely no experience. You just can't... My boss has the daffodil by the neck now, and the dejected bloom is weeping yellow ash onto the grey carpet.
Hey, we don't do can't, sweetie. When did we start doing can't? Can't is for pussies.
Was I shocked by the way Rod talked to me? Actually, you'd probably be shocked by how unshocked I was. Chauvinism is the air I breathe. A bracing blend of Gucci envy and salty gym residue. Like one of those cuboid amber air fresheners Winston hangs in the minicab. The smell stuns you as soon as you enter the city. It lays waste to your septum before curling into your brain. Soon it becomes the only smell in the world. Other odors, milk, apples, soap, seem sickly and feeble by comparison. When I first came to the city, I smelled the smell and recognized it immediately as power. Truth is, I don't mind. Let them comment on my legs if those legs help keep my children in shoes. Being a woman doesn't get you what you want within Edwin Morgan Forster, but it enables the firm to get what it wants outside. Accounts, a reputation for diversity, and they owe you for that. It's the oldest trade of all, and it's good enough for me. Sometimes I mind for other women, though. For the older ones like Claire Mainwaring in Operations, whose grey hair puts them among the firm's disappeared, and for the kids like Momo, who think that having an MBA means that guys won't look up your skirt. Round here, there are only three kinds of women. As Chris Bunce once explained to me over a drink in Corny and Barrow, back in the days when he was still hoping to get into my knickers, you're either a babe, a mumsy, or a grandma. Back then, I qualified as a babe. And the equal opportunities legislation? Doesn't make it better. Just drives the misogyny underground, into the dripping caves of the internet. Women make jokes about men on the net all the time. Wry, helpless, furious jokes. But the stuff some of the guys send... Well, a gynecologist would need to go and lie down. Let them pass as many laws as they like. Can you legislate for the cock to stop crowing? The way I look at it, women in the city are like first-generation immigrants. You get off the boat, you keep your eyes down, work as hard as you can, and do your damnedest to ignore the taunts of ignorant natives who hate you just because you look different and you smell different and because one day you might take their job. And you hope. You know it's probably not going to get that much better in your own lifetime, but just the fact that you occupy the space, the fact that they had to put a Tampax dispenser in the toilet... All that makes it easier for the women who come after you. Years ago, when I was still at school, I read this book about a cathedral by William Golding. It took several generations to build a medieval cathedral, and the men who drew up the plans knew that not their sons, but their grandsons, or even great-grandsons, would be around for the crowning of the spire they had dreamed of. It's the same for women in the city, I think. We are the foundation stones. The females who come after us will scarcely give us a second thought, but they will walk on our bones. Last year, during the photo shoot for EMF's corporate brochure, they had to borrow workers from the sandwich place in the basement to fill in the blank spaces where the women and ethnic minorities should be. I sat in some ludicrous fake meeting opposite a Colombian waitress. Eager and uncomprehending, she wore Celia Harmsworth's red Jaeger jacket, and was instructed to study a fund report. The photographer had to turn it the right way up. Later, going downstairs to pick up a bagel, I tried to catch the waitress's eye across the counter, to share a look of girly complicity. Men, what can you do? But the woman didn't even glance up from her tub of cream cheese. 4:53 p.m. Got to start work on the pitch for the ethical fund, but distracted by thoughts of Jack. And then there's Emily's birthday. 3.5 months to go, but my daughter is already counting the seconds. The desire to get to a birthday when you're 5 is as urgent as the desire to miss one when you're 35. Feeling like proper organized mother for once, I put in a call to Roger Rainbow, a clown of high repute among the mafia. Roger's answer phone informs me he is absolutely chocker every weekend, but still has some slots left for Halloween. Bloody hell. It would be easier to book the 3 tenors. Trust me to become a parent in the era when birthdays finally became a competitive sport. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Kate ready? Yes. I look up, and standing by my desk is the beautiful young woman who pressed me so hard at the trainees' induction before Christmas. Now, as then, she is blushing, but there is nothing frail or floundering in her shyness. Her reticence seems to have been cast from some fine but resilient metal. "Sorry," she says again, "but I understand we're going to be working together on an, final. Mr. Task said he felt I had an important contribution to make." I bet he did. Oh, yes, Momo. It is Momo, isn't it? I didn't imagine we'd be working together so soon. It's certainly going to be a real challenge. Come on, Kate. Give the poor girl a break. It's not her fault she's been dumped on you. I've heard so many good things about you, Momo. And vice versa, she says gratefully, taking a seat. We all, well, all the women, she gestures across the sea of suits. We don't know how you do it. Oh, is this yours? Disappearing under my desk for a second, she comes back up holding a daffodil. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's broken. Must remember. Thank you, letters. Ring mum, ring sister. Highlights. Complete IMRO forms. See amazing new film. Sitting Tiger? Sleepy Dragon? Trim Ben's nails. Ring Juno Academy of Fitness and book new personal trainer. Pelvic floor squeeze. Momo list to do. Emily school applications. Get organized. Father-in-law's 65th birthday. Tickets for Lion King? Call Jill Cooper-Clark. Social life. Invite people Sunday lunch. Simon and Kirsty. Quote for stair carpet. Note for Juanita. Packing for half term. Rue. Extra towels, nappies, porta-cot, wipes, aromatic anti-stress pillow, wellies. Chapter 14. Half term.
Kate, I am not having an argument with you about wellies.
Well, I'm having an argument with you about wellies. Emily is soaking wet. Just look at the state of her trousers. I have to remember everything, every single thing. And I swear to God, there's no room in my brain for any more information, Richard. I remembered to ask you to check the wellies were in the car.
I'm sorry, I forgot. It's not a big deal.
No, you're not sorry. If you were sorry, you'd have remembered. How much do you think the human brain can bear in the way of remembering? I read somewhere that our long-term memory is basically this giant storehouse where all the people and places and jokes and songs we've ever known are laid down like wine. But if you don't visit a memory often enough, the route to it is lost, briared over, like the approach to Sleeping Beauty's castle. Is that why all the fairy tales are about trying to find the way back? Anyway, my memory's not what it used to be, but I have to try and remember. Someone has to. What's that awful word? Multitasking. Women are meant to be great at that. But Rich, if you ask Rich to hold more than three things in his head at once, you can see smoke start to come out of his ears. The circuits have blown in there. I've heard women on the radio arguing that guys play up how useless they are in order to avoid doing stuff. Unfortunately, extensive scientific trials in the Shattercomb have revealed that the inability to remember the dry cleaning and the dishwasher tablets plus the film for the camera is, in fact, a congenital defect, like colour blindness or a dicky heart. It's not laziness, it's biology. On the endless drive to Wales on Saturday, I was watching Richard, observing the way he can screen out the kids when he needs to, when there is a destination he has in mind. Life is a road for a man. For a woman, it's a map. We're always thinking about side roads and slip roads and doubling back, while they simply plough on in the fast lane. Their only diversion is an occasional brilliant idea for a shortcut, most of which turn out to be longer and more treacherous than the original route. Is that why men can live in the moment so much better than we can? Posterity is full of men who seized the day while the women were planning for a fortnight on Tuesday. So many of the rows Rich and I have nowadays are about remembering or forgetting, like the one we had when we got to the beach in Pembrokeshire that first afternoon of the half-term holiday, and it turned out that Rich hadn't packed the children's Wellingtons. I don't know what made me go so berserk. Yes, the kids' feet were soaking, but they were having a lovely time. Swaddled in three layers of clothing, Ben and Emily play contentedly by the milk-chocolate channel that emerges from the hillside at the back of White Sands Bay and foams over stones down to the sea. She has been building a Sleeping Beauty castle with water gardens and a fountain made out of a razor shell, while he picks up a pebble, carries it to the water's edge, drops it in, and then goes back to fetch another. They are as happy and intent as I've seen them. But the weather has got worse. Of course the weather has got worse. We are on holiday in Wales. Why didn't I remember? Wet Wales. The sun broke through earlier, just long enough to see the freckles begin to swarm over Emily's face, but now the sky is pewter with rain. We decide to cut our losses and take the kids back to the cottage I have rented a few miles inland. Getting them away from the water and into the car takes roughly 50 minutes. Requests give way to threats, and when they don't work, we fall back on bribes. I promise Emily that Mummy will finally get around to reading Little Miss Busy to her. So after I've stripped off their wet clothes, given them their tea, bathed them in the tiny freezing bathroom with the wall heater that smells of burnt air, and persuaded Ben to lie in his portacot, my daughter and I settle down next to the open fire, two resentfully smouldering logs. Little Miss Busy loved nothing more than to be hard at work, keeping herself busy. Every day she would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Then Little Miss Busy would read a chapter from her favorite book. It was called Work is Good for You. Can't we read something more fun, Em?
No, I want that one.
Oh, all right. Where were we? Miss Busy wasn't happy unless she was busy working.
Mummy, you came to Ben's birthday party.
Yes, I did. I can see her thinking. 5-year-olds' thoughts are naked. They haven't learned to cloak them yet. This one ripples across Emily's brow like a breeze over a dune.
Did the teacher say you could leave early?
She asks at last. No, sweetheart. Mummy doesn't have a teacher. She has, well, she has a boss, this man who's in charge, and she has to ask him if she can leave.
Could you ask that man if you could come home early other days?
No, well, yes, I could, but I can't do it too often.
Why?
Because Mummy has to be in the office, or otherwise people might get cross with her. Let's finish the story, Em. Little Miss Busy,
could you come home early and take me to ballet on Thursdays? Please, can you, Mama?
Paula takes you to ballet, darling, and she says you're really, really good at it. And Mummy promises to try and come to your show at the end of term this time.
But it's not fair. Ella's mum takes her to ballet.
Emily, I really haven't got time to argue with you now. Let's finish the story, shall we? And Miss Busy didn't rest all day long, not for a minute, not even for a second. When they were both asleep upstairs, Rich accused me of not being relaxed, and I got incredibly upset. I'd done 3 solid hours of Lionel Bart's Oliver in the car on the way down, hadn't I? Where is love? Does it fall from skies above? Does it hell? Mark Lester was so desperately beautiful as Oliver, and I read the other day that now he's an osteopath in Cheltenham or somewhere. I mean, that can't be right, can it? Like the breaking of a magic spell. And after Oliver, we sang 20 choruses of The Wheels on the Bus, which I did most cheerfully, even though that song drives me absolutely nuts. Then, when Ben threw up in the car outside Swansea, I got him into the service station, washed him in the basin, dried him somehow with the one dry paper towel, and changed him before buying all the basics we'd need when we got to the cottage. Tea bags, milk, sliced bread for toast. I was doing a pretty good impersonation of a mummy on holiday, wasn't I? But Rich was right. Thoughts of the upcoming final that Rod had sprung on me were keeping me awake at night. I'd left Momo to do the research into the ethical pharmaceutical sector while I was away, but she simply didn't have the experience to hack her way through the material in time. Twice a day I called her from a phone box in a high-hedged lane or by some rasping pebbled shore. My mobile signal came and went like the tide. And of course I told Momo where to find stuff, but it was like asking a skateboarder to dock a space station. Specifically instructed Guy to help her out too, but while I was away he would be otherwise engaged, having his bony Machiavellian arse measured for my chair. No way was Guy going to do anything that would put me in a good light. Plus, as the cottage's phone connection was practically steam-powered, I couldn't pick up my emails. Being out of contact with Abelhammer for 4 days made me realize how much I relied upon him as a safety valve. Without his soothing attentions, I was ready to explode. Thursday, a car park, St. David's Cathedral, 3:47 p.m. I'm unloading Ben's buggy from the boot of the car when the downpour starts. Joke rain, Crazy Rain, Gene Kelly singing in the sodding rain rain. Try to wrestle the baby into the buggy straps, his body stiffening as my impatience grows. I feel like an asylum orderly putting a straitjacket on a madman. Richard has fetched the buggy rain cover and hands it over. It's a fiendish combination of cling film and climbing frame. Boldly loop big hoop over Ben's head and try to fasten the clips, but I cannot get them round buggy handles, so attach to the fabric instead. Seems okay, but I'm left with two elastic loops. What the hell are they for? Drape remainder of cover over the baby's feet, but the rain snatches it and whips it up into my face. Damn. Start again.
Come on, Kate, says Richard. We're getting soaked here. Surely you know how to put that cover on.
I surely don't know. How would I know? Only contact with Wretched Thing was handing over Visa card in John Lewis 13 months ago, and when the assistant tried to demonstrate the rain cover, snapping at her, I'll just take it, thanks. Can hardly call Paula in Morocco and ask how to use own child's equipment. Ben is howling now. Drops of rain join the tributary of snot running over his lips to form a cataract of misery. Have you noticed how all baby equipment comes with the promise of easy assembly? This is industry shorthand for only those with NASA training need attempt.
For Christ's sake, Kate,
hisses Richard, who will put up with anything except embarrassment in public.
I'm trying! I'm trying! Emily, don't go near the cars. Emily, come here this minute.
A coach has pulled up alongside us and disgorged a tour party of 70-somethings, ladies of the valleys with freshly baked perms and short padded coats that give their trunks the appearance of boilers lagged to save on fuel. As one, they dive into their handbags and produce those slithery packets that open out into instant see-through sou'westers. There they stand, twittering companionably and observing my struggle.
"Oh, poor Dab," says one, gesturing towards my bawling son. "Getting wet, is he? Never mind. Mummy'll have you right in a minute."
My fingers are blunt with cold. Can barely hold the bloody clip, let alone open it. Under the wrong piece of plastic, an enraged Ben is as puce as packaged beetroot. I turn to the ladies. "New pram," I say loudly, and they all nod and smile, eager to be drawn into womanly complicity against the hopeless man-made machine.
"They make stuff so stiff now, don't they?" says one woman in check trews, taking the rain cover from me, nimbly flipping it over the buggy and fastening it with practiced clicks. "My daughter's just the same as you," she says, briefly laying a hand on my shoulder. "Dr. Upridge Endway now she is. Two little boys. Hard work, mind. You don't get no holidays, do you?"
I shake my head and try to smile, but my lips are rigid with cold. The woman's hands are raw and bony, the tendons like red ropes. A mother's hands, one who did the washing up 3 times a day, peeled the veg and stirred the terry nappies in their scummy cauldron. Hands like that will die out in another generation, along with waist pinnies and the Sunday roast. Bowed double against the rain, Richard pushes the buggy along the little road to the cathedral. Emily is so drenched she has made the transformation from child to water sprite.
"Mummy?"
"What is it, Emily?"
"Baby Jesus has got a lot of houses, hasn't he? Is this where he comes on his holidays?"
"I don't know, sweetie. Ask Daddy." Cathedrals are built to inspire awe. Sacred fortresses, they always look as though they have been lowered from heaven onto a hill. St. David's is different. It sits on the edge of a small Welsh town, a city in name only, hiding its virtues in a valley so perfectly designed it feels like an engraving. Cattle graze almost up to its walls. I love this place. The ancient chill that fills your lungs when you push open the door. The trapped breath of saints, I always think. I must have been 7 or 8 the first time I came here. Candy floss from Tenby on my lips. Licking them now, I can still taste its cobwebby sweetness. I have seen grander cathedrals since, of course. Notre Dame, Seville, St. Paul's. But the greatness of this church lies in its smallness, barely bigger than a barn, really. You wouldn't be surprised to find an ox and an ass by the font. St. David's is one of the few places that bids me be still. And here in the nave I realize that, these days, stillness is an unaccustomed, even an uncomfortable sensation. The cathedral is timeless, and my life is nothing but time. Richard has taken Emily and Ben to explore the gift shop. Left alone, I find my mouth forming words no one can hear. Help me. Asking a god I'm not sure I believe in to get me out of a mess I don't understand. Oh, very good, Kate. Very good. On the far wall there is a slate tablet commemorating a local grandee, in memory of somebody Thomas and of his relict Angarad. Relict? Same as relic? We'll have to ask Rich. He's good at Latin. Had a proper education, not the comprehensive shambles I had to put up with. Outside, a vertiginous gingerbread staircase links the cathedral to the tiny city on the hill. I haul the buggy backwards up the steps, feeling each bump in my lower vertebrae. Rich carries a squally Emily on his shoulders. She and Ben badly need their tea. Guilty, bad mother. I always forget children are like cars. Without regular injections of fuel, they judder and stop. We walk down a street full of cafes and peer through the windows, inspecting each one for child friendliness. Is there room for the buggy? Are there older people in there who would rather not share their toasted crumpets with a dribbly Ben? Britain is still no country for young children. Venture too far from Pizza Express, and you find the same resentful sighs I remember from when Julie and I were kids. We settle on a chintzy establishment full of other holiday parents, as spooked and unrested as us, and make for the farthest corner. Draped over the backs of our chairs, our wet coats steam like cows. I read out the menu, and Emily announces loudly that she doesn't want anything that's on offer. She wants pasta. "We can do hoops from a tin, like," offers the kindly waitress.
"I don't want hoops," wails Emily. "I want pasta."
Metropolitan brat. All my fault for giving her everything so young. I didn't taste my first pasta till I was 19 years old. Rome. Spaghetti alla vongole. Clammy in both senses. A shaming ordeal of alien shells and unmanageable strands. Sometimes I worry that I've travelled this far, done this well in life, only for my kids to grow up as jaded and spoiled as the people I was patronised by at college. As Rich cuts up the children's Welsh rarebit, there is a little twiddly beep from my mobile. It's a text message from Guy. Turkey crisis. Rod and RCC away. Devaluation? Turk shares collapsing. What do? Oh, hell. Jump up. Barge past other families, trip over Labrador, run into street. Try mobile, but this time it's making another kind of beep, telling me the battery is low. Can't get a signal. Of course I can't get a signal. I'm in Wales. Run back into the cafe. Have you a phone I can use? Excuse me? The waitress looks blank. A payphone? Oh, yes, but it's not working, like. A fax? Fax? A facsimile machine. I need to send an urgent message. Oh, they might have one over the paper shop. Newsagent has no fax. He thinks chemist has fax. Chemist does have fax. Fax needs paper. Back to paper shop. About to close. Bang on door. Beg. Have to buy brick of 500 sheets, of which I need precisely one. Back to chemist. I scrawl a note to Guy using the prescription pen which is tethered to the counter. Guy, must weigh up risk of Turkish trade failing and being charged interest rates of 2,000%. Could cost us shed load of money. Versus loss in value of shares if currency devalues. 1. How much have we got in Turkey? 2. What's market doing? Knock-on effect, other regions. Answers on my desk tomorrow, 8:30 a.m. Coming back right now, Kate. 9:50 p.m. There are huge jams in both directions on the M4. The headlights form a 3-mile diamond necklace. From the driving seat, Rich shoots me inquiring, sidelong glances. I am grateful for the dark. It means I don't have to pick up his distress signals until I feel ready. Finally, he says, I still think it's a bit odd, Kate, you sending yourself those flowers on Valentine's Day. Why did you do it?
As a morale boost. I wanted people in the office to feel I was the kind of person who got flowers on Valentine's Day, and I wasn't sure you'd remember. Pathetic, really.
Easy to lie when you try. Easier than saying that the flowers came from client with whom I have recently dined, client who has since occupied much of my conscious mind as well as rudely gate-crashing my dreams. Time to change the subject.
Rich, what's a relict? I saw it on a tomb in the cathedral today. And his relict, Angerad.
Widow. It means literally what is left behind.
So the wife was the remains of the husband.
Exactly, Kate.
He laughs.
Of course, in our marriage, I'd be what was left of you.
It's said with enough love to sting. Do I really make him feel that way? That small? Over the miles to come, I embroider any number of plans, strategies to make things better between us, put things right. But 3 hours later, as we pass Reading, I start to feel the gravitational pull of London, and the resolve to change my life burns up on re-entry. Reasons to give up work and go and live in country. 1. Better quality of life. 2. Can buy a mansion with ensuite minstrels gallery for cost of hackney heap. 3. Chance to be real mother who has time to love husband, learn secret of children's hearts, and discover how bloody buggy rain cover works. Reasons not to give up work and go live in country. 1. Would go mad. 2. See above. 3. See above. Part 3. Chapter 15. The Pigeons. Where is a bird of prey when you need one? Since early this morning, two pigeons have been sitting on the ledge outside my office window, on their first date, apparently. For an hour or so, the male seemed to be bowing to the female, making polite little waiterly dips in front of her. Well, I assume that's the male, because the other one is the colour of dishwater and lowers her head in a coy Princess Di way, while he has this magnificent ruff of feathers round his neck, emerald and purple, with a petroleum sheen. It wasn't so bad when the male was whispering sweet nothings, but now he's strutting about with his tail spread out in a fan, hissing and whistling to attract the female's attention. The noise is unbelievable. Like having the entire percussion section of the London Symphony Orchestra inside my ear. I give several sharp raps on the window to scare the birds away, but the courting couple only have eyes for each other. I call over to Guy and tell him to get the corporation on the phone right away and ask for some guidance on pigeons. Guy puts on his Jeeves face. Do you want me to arrange to have them shot, Kate? No, Guy. They've got a hawk to take them out. Can you ask them when he's making his next visit? It's a little-known fact that the City of London employs a falconer who brings his sparrowhawk along every month to control the pigeon population. Last time he was here, Candy and I were on our way to lunch, and my unshockable American friend was astonished to see a large countryman with a single leather gauntlet launching a feathered missile into the air above our heads. If you've ever wondered why the city has such clean pavements compared to the rest of London, there's your answer, I said.
Oh, I get it, Candy grinned. That way they keep all the shit on the inside.
To Kate Reddy from Deborah Richardson.
How are you? Me so stressed after 3 days of half-term wanted to check into the Priory. Do they do a work withdrawal program for sad junkies like us? We went to a child-friendly hotel in Somerset. Felix got us banned after fusing electrics in the breakfast room, plugged his Thunderbird's fork into the communal toaster, and the whole place went dark. Ruby says she hates me. Are we just causing our children short-term damage, do you think? Or will there be major lawsuits later on? Lunch on Wednesday, right? Yours in denial. Kisses.
To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer. Subject, Japanese banking crisis.
It is with some concern that your client notes the continuing upheaval in the Far Eastern sector. I understand Origami Bank has folded, Sumo Bank has gone belly up, and Bonsai Bank has plans to cut back several smaller branches. Can I get some direction on this, ma'am? Kisses.
to Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. Subject, Japanese banking crisis. Don't you have a business empire to run, sir? Jokes about the plight of our Oriental friends are in very poor taste, although I did hear shares in Kamikaze Bank have nosedived and 500 back-office staff at Karate Bank got the chop. Catherine, kisses. To Kate Reddy from Jack Abelhammer.
Hey, I missed you. I've grown accustomed to your pace. How was the vacation? Hot and relaxing, I hope. Saw this great movie the other night about a guy who lost his memory, so he has to write all the stuff he needs to remember on his body. I thought of you. You said you always had so much stuff to remember, right? Jack, kisses.
To Jack Abelhammer from Kate Reddy. Not hot and not relaxing, exactly. Still cold here. Passed a guy on the ice rink outside the office this morning. He was doing these cool loops and swivels, as though he was writing his name on the ice. Or even someone else's. How romantic is that? Correct about the movie, though. Most of my body is covered in detailed notes already. But I have a spot left for you, behind my left knee. To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
I skate a little, do you? We could try a few moves on thin ice one day. As for the left knee, be right there, just feathering my quill.
10:23 a.m. Now the damned pigeon has started clapping his wings together, like he's giving himself this big round of applause for being such a great lover. The female, meanwhile, is doing the birdie equivalent of lying on her back and waving her legs in the air. Completely intolerable. I manage to open the window and try to shoo them away. But love, it turns out, is deaf as well as blind. So much to do, I'm surprised that my head is not lolling to one side with the weight of activity in there. In 2 days, I will be attending a final in the U.S. for a $300 million ethical pension fund, which I will be presenting with a 20-something graduate trainee who has all the qualifications for the job, not white, not male, except being able to do the job. Between us, Momo Gumarantney and I will signal EMF's passionate commitment to diversity, a commitment whose finest hour till now has been the inclusion of tacos on the cafeteria menu. Also, I have still not secured the services of an entertainer for Emily's birthday party. Also, I must pick up clothes for the final from the cleaners. Also, there was definitely another also. Damn, that's all I need. A memo on my desk from Robin Cooper Clark says there's an internal investigation into some stock EMF sold that we didn't actually have. I push the memo across the desk to Momo and tell her to go and put it on Chris Bunce's desk. But make sure he doesn't see you, okay? The leaf-shaped eyes curl up at the corners as she scans the paper. We sold stock we didn't have, and now there's a claim against us, and Robin wants to know who is responsible.
Correct.
So we find out whose fault it is? No, Momo. The aim is to keep passing the buck until you wear the others down. Are you familiar with the game Musical Chairs, yes? Well, this is Musical Memos. The last person left holding the paper is in deep shit. So if you could just deliver that to Bunce's desk, now... I am beginning to recognize the expression on my new assistant's face. A sort of tremulous frown where high principle struggles with a fervent desire to please. Sorry, Kate, but how do we know Chris Bunce is to blame? I swivel my chair away from her to stop me losing my cool. Outside on the ledge, the pigeon family tableau is framed by a crane like a giant set square. How to account for a man who in conversation unconsciously grabs at his crotch as if to check his manhood is still there, or rubs it in excitement when he thinks he's about to get the better of someone, particularly me. Look, Bunce is a seat-of-the-pants artist who never does any of his admin and leaves it to conscientious girlies like you and me to do all the boring stuff that satisfies the authorities. If Imro knew what Bunce got up to, they'd be in here with a team of Alsatians. But Bunce is very good at getting away with it because he himself plays a mean game of musical memos. Am I making myself clear yet? Sorry, Momo says, as another person would say, okay, and walks across the office, holding the memo out in front of her like a sapper with an unexploded mine.
Are you going to be able to train her up?
Candy is standing by my desk, wearing a skirt so short it's practically a text message. I didn't even hear her come over. I don't know. I'm trying to introduce Momo to the idea that not everyone is a nice person.
Oh, my God. We're not talking about a functional childhood, are we?
Afraid so. Candy shakes her head in wonder and pity.
Poor kid. She'll never get anywhere.
11:25 a.m. Determined to get my new personal organizer up and running. The pocket memory will revolutionize my life. The pocket memory will banish stress. The pocket memory will make my time work harder for me. After 10 minutes reading the starter pack leaflet, I discover that the pocket memory is not compatible with my computer. I call the helpline. The school dropout at the other end delivers his prepared script with all the facility of a man translating from the Urdu.
Have you got a large serial port in the back, madam?
Of me or the computer? How the hell should I know?
What you need, madam, is a connect kit.
No, what I need is to make my personal organizer organize.
You may order our connect kit now, madam. Should you wish to proceed,
excuse me, is this part of your promise to simplify my life? Couldn't I just go to a shop and get the kit?
There aren't that many available, madam. People order them. It will take from 5 to 10 days to arrive.
I don't have 5 to 10 days. I'm leaving for the States in 24 hours.
I'm afraid we can't...
Can't is for pussies.
I beg your pardon, madam.
It's an old Australian proverb meaning, tell your manager that I have several million shares in his company which are currently under review and that our market research reports are not showing them in a favourable light. Am I making myself clear? There is an audible swallow.
I'll have to have a word with the supervisor.
Tuesday, 8:11 a.m. So it's come to this. Richard and I actually lay in bed last night discussing whether we were too tired to have sex. Couldn't quite remember what conclusion we reached until I got up this morning and noticed that inner thighs were lightly glued together with glacé icing. Not a good idea before a major presentation. Sportsmen always say they never have sex in the run-up to a big race or match, don't they? You never hear women athletes complain about it, but it must be the same for them, if not worse. There can be little to rival the female orgasm for knocking you out cold. Hours after the earth moves, a deep, tentacular weariness is still trying to drag you under. Coming, I mean really coming, makes you want to go and lie down till Christmas. I reckon it must be Mother Nature's way of giving the sperm the best possible shot at the egg. When you think about it, almost everything in female biology is Mother Nature's way of making us want a baby or, when we have one, of making us want to protect it. Up until last year, I suffered from mild PMT. Not nothing, but nowhere near the crampy hell some women go through. Then, as soon as I hit 35, it was war. Every month now, the hormones are out in the streets, jumping up and down, waving placards and shouting, "Save our eggs!" My body appears to know that time is short, and the passing of each egg is mourned like the loss of a precious stone, a pearl beyond price. But how can I have another baby when I don't see the ones I've got? I've hardly been home these past few days. I look up at the office clock, and if it's after 8, I know I've missed the kids' bedtimes, and, well, I figure I may as well push on for the night. Momo orders in a pizza, or we have something healthy from the canteen in a styrofoam box. Always inedible, and we end up with our usual midnight feast, a bag of tortilla chips and a couple of crunchies from the machine, washed down with Diet Coke. Picked up the phone when I finally got in last night at 11:55, expecting it to be Momo with some more figures. And who did I get? Barbara, my mother-in-law. Couldn't believe she was ringing that late.
Tell me not to stick my oar in where it's not wanted, Catherine, but I spoke to Richard earlier, and he sounded very tired. I hope everything's all right.
She thinks he's tired? 10:07 a.m. In a meeting with Rod, Momo, and Guy. We are rehearsing the final for the third time, with Rod and Guy taking the parts of the clients, when Rod's secretary, Lorraine, bursts in.
Sorry to interrupt, Kate,
but there's someone for you on line 3. He says you said it was urgent. But who is it?
Lorraine appears reluctant to say. She stands awkwardly in the doorway until finally, in a stage whisper, she volunteers,
"It's a Percy Pineapple."
Guy rolls his eyes so languidly he's practically looking backwards into his own skull. Momo gazes at her shoes.
"Who the fuck's Percy Pineapple?"
asks Rod amiably.
I decide to brazen it out. "Oh, yes, that'll be Percy Pineapple, the entertainment stock, part of Fruitscape.com, which is coming to the market. Chairman is coming in to see me to discuss the float, just his little joke."
Dear God, still no entertainer for Emily's party. Have worked my way through the trusted favourites, Roger Rainbow, ZZ the Clown, and Katie Cupcake, who does the most marvellous things with Smarties and an air pump. All have prior engagements in Monaco or Las Vegas or are dancing attendance on some anal-retentive mother superior who had the paper plates and napkins picked out for Jocasta's 7th birthday by the time her waters broke. I am rapidly sliding down the food chain and have entered the small ad territory of bearded loons whose mugshots have an uncanny overlap with those printed in the News of the World Name and Shame paedophile campaign. There was a flash of hope on Monday when Percy Pineapple of Gravesend said that for 120 quid, no questions asked, love, he could drive up in his van and put on a lovely show for the little girl. But Percy's leaflet came in the post this morning. It shows a chubby homunculus twisting Durex pink balloons into worryingly priapic dachshunds. Of course, what Emily really wants is a swimming party, but that is totally out of the question. At the pool you hire for such occasions, the water is tepid, bacteria-rich, and, unlike most water, not transparent. Also, would have to take time off for bikini wax. Cannot do public nudity with other parents. 11:19 p.m. Arrive home to discover pocket memory connect kit on the hall table. Richard is shipwrecked on the sofa, watching the Arsenal game. He has left me some pasta in the oven. It has the texture and smell of baked toes. Would it be totally out of the question for anyone except me to take stuff left at the bottom of the stairs upstairs? Rich doesn't look up from the TV.
Ah, the great she returns. Is it that time of the month already?
Are you accusing me of having PMT?
Rich yelps.
God, Kate. I look back to your premenstrual tension with nostalgia. These days, you have postmenstrual tension, intermenstrual tension. We have 24/7 tension. Can you switch off when you eventually come to bed, or will you be issuing instructions in your sleep?
I open the dishwasher and notice that the supposedly clean dishes have a tide mark of grey sediment. Damn machine must be on the blink.
It may have escaped your notice, Rich, but I have a major presentation.
For it to have escaped my notice, I would have had to have been embalmed in Ulaanbaatar.
I do this for us, you know.
What us, Kate? The kids haven't seen you since we got back from Wales. Maybe you should become a TV presenter. At least they'd catch you once a day on screen.
Standing in the doorway, watching my husband's baffled misery from a long, long way off, I think how I know this situation so well, and I know the ways out of it. Either leave for the airport in the morning with a frost on the ground and hope it has melted by the time I get back, or take my clothes off right now and remind both of us that love is something you can make. I'm so exhausted, my body feels like a carcass. No, it feels like a living body carrying a dead one on its back. But I can't bear to leave him like this, and some kinds of sex take less time and energy than others.
Please be on my side, Rich, I say to him as I get to my feet a few minutes later. It's me by myself in the office, against them. I can't be on my own at home as well.
1:01 a.m. Have almost finished transferring all the information I need into the pocket memory when there is a cry from upstairs. 4:17 a.m. Emily up 3 times already, wrestling with her duvet, damp hair drying in crusty tendrils on her pale cheek. Can't tell me what's wrong. How can she do this to me tonight of all nights? I have to leave for the airport in 3 hours. Immediate stab of guilt for even thinking such a thought. Then, just when I've decided this is a preemptive punishment for leaving her, like a cat, Emily senses a departure before the suitcase is brought down. She finally moans,
"Mummy, my wee-wee hurts."
Pour her a large cup of cranberry juice and spend the next 20 minutes on the phone trying to get through to an emergency doctor. He suggests I give her Calpol and take a urine sample into the surgery first thing. Downstairs I try to find the nearest thing to a specimen bottle, something watertight but big enough for her to pee into. Only thing I can find is a Barbie flask. It will have to do. Back upstairs, kneeling next to the toilet, I have no luck coaxing a wincing M to perform into the flask.
Mummy?
Yes, love?
Can I have a swimming party?
Of course, sweetheart. Flask is instantly filled to the brim. Noon, JFK Airport, New York. A hulking customs inspector, bearing a strong resemblance to Sipowich in NYPD Blue, rifles through my hand luggage. Totally unconcerned, I look on as he takes out my mobile, spare tights, and Percy the puppy book, dips his meaty hand into a side pocket, and brings out the Barbie flask. Oh, my God! Was supposed to leave that on the kitchen table. If flask is here, where is pocket memory? Customs inspector unscrews Barbie container and sniffs.
Ma'am, how would you describe this liquid?
It's my daughter's urine.
Ma'am, I think you'd better come with me.
Must remember. Absolutely bloody everything. Chapter 16, The Final. Wednesday, Fairweather Inn, Shanksville, New Jersey. Awake since 4 a.m., trapped in the revolving door of jet lag. Room service doesn't start till 6, so I get a rank metallic coffee from machine in the hallway and add a slug of miniature from the minibar. Whiskey gives a sustained top note to the hell brew. Catch sight of old woman in the bathroom mirror. Look away. This morning, I dress for battle in full Armani armor. It is incredibly comforting pulling on a crisp white blouse and a digestive biscuit brown jacket and skirt with seams so sharp you could perform surgery with them. Shoes are fudge-coloured L.K. Bennett pencil heels with white stitching and a groin-piercing toe. The look I'm aiming for is Katharine Hepburn kicks ass. 2 hours before the final, and Momo joins me in the room. She is wearing a blue silk suit, and her dark hair is scraped back and pinned up. She may be nervous within, but she looks so mysteriously serene that a religion ought to be founded in her name. Today I have to be confident for both of us, exuding the gale force bonhomie of a game show host who knows his contract is up for renewal. We've been through the presentation 50 times already, but there's no harm reprising all the don'ts. If they offer you a drink, don't take it, okay? Don't call them by their first names, whatever you do. This is an ethical fund. These people like to think of themselves as the kind of people who like to be gregged and hannered, but if you try it, they'll suddenly realize how much they prefer to be deferred to. They're thinking about trusting us with an awful lot of money, so it's sir and ma'am all round. And remember, we are the suitors. Momo looks surprised. It's a flirtation. Yes, only we don't.